Welcome to the Equipping You in Grace podcast. We are so excited that you are joining us for the show today. This podcast aims to explore a biblical life view in a conversational tone. Let's join our host and founder of Servants of Grace, Dave Jenkins, for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening.
Welcome back to the Equipping You in Grace podcast. My name is Dave, and I'm the host for this podcast. And with me today is Dr. Kidd. Dr. Kidd, welcome back to the Equipping You in Grace podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, it's always great to chat with you, whether over here or on the podcast or over email, so I appreciate it. Can you just catch us up on what's going on in your life, marriage, ministry, and what are you working on project-wise?
Well, 2019 is a pretty busy year for me. Publishing-wise, we're going to talk about this American History textbook that I've just come out with, but I've got a couple more books coming out this year. One is called Who is an Evangelical? That's getting into the whole debate about what the word evangelical means and how it's been watered down and politicized in the past 30 or 40 years. And then I have an overview of American religious history that's coming out in November with Zondervan. That's just a broad overview of American religious history. My most recent project that I'm actively writing right now is a biography of Thomas Jefferson that is a conventional biography in a way, but it gives special attention to his religious beliefs and how his religious beliefs informed or did not inform his personal life, including his slave owning and those sorts of things. So I'm working on the early stages of that, and Lord willing, that'll be out maybe in 2021 or possibly 2022. So, but of course, I keep teaching at Baylor in the history department, and I've also recently taken on a visiting position at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where I'll be teaching some church history classes and working with doctoral students there.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm excited that you are teaching at Midwestern. They continue to bring in excellent faculty, and I'm excited that you're joining the team there, and excited about your future writing project. So keep up the good work, brother.
Thanks.
Can you please tell us a bit about your book, American History, Volume 1 and 2, why you wrote it and how it's being received?
Sure. Well, this book was commissioned by B&H Academic, Southern Baptist Press. They are interested in getting involved with the Christian college market, not just for theology and biblical studies, which they've mostly done in the past, but also for more traditional liberal arts subjects like history. They thought, and I agreed, that there was a need in the introductory American history surveys at Christian colleges, especially for a American history textbook that was written from a Christian perspective, but that also brought a kind of professional historical learning study to bear on the subject. A lot of times at Christian colleges, the professors are kind of faced with a choice of either using secular textbooks that are written by professional historians, or maybe using kind of popular histories written by Christians, but that in my view, sometimes tend to overstate, like, how many of the founding fathers are born again and things like that, and really try to push the kind of Christian America angle. And so we thought that there would be an opportunity there for a kind of middle way, a third way type of textbook that is written from a Christian worldview and certainly gives a lot of attention, including through contemporary America, to religious themes. And in the secular textbooks in particular, religion tends to fade out after the Second Great Awakening. The secular textbooks tend not to give much attention to religion, maybe like the Scopes Trial, maybe the Moral Majority, but other than that, they tend to neglect it in the second half of American history. And so that's another difference, is I persist in my attention to a religion in American history all the way through the present, which is fitting with it being a Christian press, but I think also helps to account for America's pervasively religious character, even through present day. Even though there's so much talk about religious decline in America, we're still far more religious than, say, the countries of Western Europe that were so influential in the founding of America compared to England, for instance. I mean, America is far more religious still today. And so that extended attention to religion, I think, helps to give some context for that fact that professional historians certainly know about, but often have not given much attention to it in their textbooks.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And as I was reading, I was noting that, you're taking a very theological approach, tracing, the development. You even talk about theology in the book, which, I'm a theology geek, as you know. And so I really appreciated that. I think other people will appreciate that. It's a different way of, I think it's a very, as you just noted, it's the right way to do history, especially talking about, how America was founded. One question that you brought up, what are specifically your problems with the idea of, the founding of America being, Christian, those types of things?
Well, I think you just have to break it down to, a little more specific questions than, was America founded as a Christian nation or not? Because it operates at different levels. I mean, on one level, the First Amendment makes clear that the national government is there to guarantee free exercise of religion, but that the Congress can't create an established religion, which in 1787, everybody understood what that meant was that you couldn't have an official national church like the Church of England. So in the ways that people understood religion's influence on a nation in 1787, when the Constitution was framed, it was definitely a step towards church-state separation and more of a free market of religion. And so, Christianity on a national level definitely did not have an established legal status the way that it did in the nations of their background, most obviously England. But that definitely didn't mean that Christianity was unimportant in the founding. The kind of free market of religion that the founders create, I think, put Christianity on a stronger footing in America than it was in England, where the Church of England was and still is today the established church of the nation. But when you compare the national histories of America and England, the freedom that we have with regard to religion has made Christianity in America, I think, overall more vital, more voluntary, more robust, certainly through present day, than it is in England, where the Church of England plays a very marginal role for everyday people in England, very high levels still comparatively of Americans at least claim to go to church on Sundays. And I think a lot of that has to do with the freedom of religion that we have in this kind of free market of religion that the founders gave us. So, I mean, you can see, and there's lots of other issues you could get into, about how many of the major founding fathers were traditional Orthodox Christians and so forth. But even that issue of church-state separation and declining to have an official national church, I think, shows that the question of Christianity's official status is pretty clear that they were not going to have an official denomination, but still Christianity plays a major role in influencing the founders' ideas about government and virtue and morality and what the best kind of republic was. So those are some of my kind of problems is that you just have to be a little bit more nuanced than a lot of the discussions are in the kind of, what was America founded as a Christian nation or not? That question doesn't really allow for much nuance.
Yeah, I think that's really, really helpful. Well, why should American Christians study American history?
Well, I think that for sure American Christians would want to be interested in American religious history because it's your religious autobiography in a way, and the church in America is always influenced by its surrounding culture and politics and social development. And so I think any of us, this is not unique to Christians, but Christians should be interested in sources of wisdom and understanding, especially with regard to the church. And the past is how we got to the present. So, you know, when we're worried about contemporary controversy, whether it be theological or social or cultural controversy and so forth, which churches typically are worried about contemporary controversies like that, we always gain more understanding into those issues by reference to the past. And so, for instance, if it's an issue like immigration and ethnic conflict and so forth, which is such a hot button issue today, it is just obviously useful and relevant to know that these issues about immigration have a very long history in America, that in, say, the 1850s, the 19-teens, the 1920s, the immigration issue was as big of a political controversy, if not bigger, than it is today. Just that fact and looking at how it played out, I think is a storehouse of wisdom for all people, including Christians, to understand how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. You know, we got to avoid, as C.S. Lewis said, chronological snobbery, and right. We got to study history, our history, so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. Mm-hmm. Where would you say was a major turning point in our history as Americans that pointed people away from Christianity, and why?
Well, I think that there's a lot of places that you could look, and I think that there's things that happened in the Civil War about our inability as a nation to come to some kind of common understanding about slavery and morality was a really jarring experience for many American Christians. But I think one of the reasons that I think we need some nuance about the American founding period is that already by the time of the founding, there are major skeptical publications coming out that are hostile towards traditional Christianity. One of the most obvious ones is Tom Paine's book, The Age of Reason, that comes out in the 1790s, and it is a vicious attack on traditional Christianity and on the Bible itself. And Paine, of course, had been the author of Common Sense in 1776, which is the most important political pamphlet of the American Revolution. And so Paine was a very prominent writer. And The Age of Reason is a best-selling book in the 1790s, so not long after independence and the founding of the new nation. And it is, in its way, as rabid an assault on traditional Christianity and the Bible as anything you would find today. And so if we think about the time of the founding as some kind of pristine, almost naive time of common acceptance of Christian belief and that sort of thing, it's not true. There were very public skeptics at the time, Paine being the most notorious. And it's not as if he was just out there on a limb by himself. I mean, that book sold thousands and thousands of copies, and it was one of the best-selling books of the 1790s for sure in America. And so there was an active audience for anti-Christian, anti-Bible writing almost at the very beginning of the new nation. You know, I think that when you look at what happened in the 20th century with a growing role for atheism, and sexual license, and I think cultural degradation starting in the 1960s. All those things are true, that those were problems in turning us away from traditional faith as a culture. But this is another area where when you look at the past and see how early those kinds of voices appeared in American history, you start realizing that some of the challenges that we're facing culturally today are not exactly brand new.
Yeah. If I'm remembering this right, and it's been, probably 15 years since I took a history of American philosophy class. So correct me if I'm wrong here. But, I think that what I remember from that class is basically Thomas Paine and his influence on, universities like Harvard and Yale and you know, these places were started as we know, like Harvard to train and Yale to train pastors and those types of things, and they started to go away from the influence of like Thomas Paine and evolution, you know, Charles Darwin and just the confluence of those ideas that were coming and assaulting, you know, traditional Christian teaching.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems that every generation has kind of a new cycle of this. I mean, you know, Yale was founded in 1701, really as a conservative alternative to Harvard, because Harvard had been founded in 1636. And already by 1700, liberalism, which in 1700 basically meant anti-Calvinism, was already taking hold at Harvard. And so there were Congregationalist pastors in New England who thought that there needed to be kind of a conservative alternative, and that became Yale. And so it seems like we just go through these cycles of you know, creeping liberalism and then conservative alternatives. It doesn't seem to usually go the other way. I don't know why, but all those things, and so, you know, so patterns like that are happening in reaction to Darwinianism and all that. But I'm struck again by how early these kinds of things start happening in America, where at least to critics, Harvard had already gone liberal by 1700, and so, you know, well before the Declaration of Independence. And so those kind of challenges seem to be just perennially with us.
Yeah, that's really helpful. What's your favorite period of American history and why?
Of course, I find it all interesting, and I think a lot of historians feel like they could, you know, study virtually any time period and find things that would fascinate them. I think for me, I find the period of the First Great Awakening in the 1740s to be my favorite time period, just because it's the time in American history where I think, unless you're just skeptical about God's role in history, it's the time where I see the most discernible, massive work of God in American history. And even Christian historians tend to be kind of hesitant about saying, you know, God was doing this or God was doing that in anything outside of the Bible. But boy, in the First Great Awakening, I mean, it's just a powerful work of God, not unalloyed. I mean, there's problems in the First Great Awakening, excesses, which seem always to come along with true revival. There's also some excesses. But I think for me personally, I identify, I'm Baptist myself, an evangelical and a Baptist, and I think if I could choose to at least visit, if not live among a certain group of Christians after the book of Acts, I think pretty close to the top of the list for me would be those evangelicals in the 1740s and 50s and the incredible missionary efforts that were coming out. It's the first time that the Baptists really get into the South. I mean, at a time where there are virtually no Baptists in the South, if you can imagine that. And it's just an exciting time for me as a Christian. So if I had to choose, I would say that's my favorite time.
That definitely bears out in your writing for sure. So that's awesome. Who in our history has had a great influence on the Christian church as a whole?
I think that probably the one person that I would identify as being someone who had a huge influence, but maybe is a little less known, as George Whitefield. Certainly in some evangelical circles today, Whitefield is a little better known. But of the three figures who are the primary leaders of the Great Awakening in Britain and America, it's Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley and George Whitefield. And I think of those three, that Whitefield is the least well known today. And the reason for that is because Edwards' brilliance is captured in his writing, and his writings are very well studied, especially among Christians today. And then Wesley leaves the institutional legacy of the Methodist Church, which remains a large and important denomination, though in some ways it's strayed from some of Wesley's legacy today. But then Whitefield's brilliance, and if any of your listeners are not as familiar with Whitefield, he was the most important evangelist to the Great Awakening, and his brilliance was captured in his preaching as delivered. I think his sermons are very fine sermons. They're not as theologically brilliant as Edwards' sermons are, but they're heavyweight sermons. Whitfield's are. But I always tell my students that I wish of anybody outside of the Bible that I wish I had a YouTube clip of, it would be George Whitfield, because he, by all accounts, was just a phenomenally gifted preacher, maybe the greatest preacher ever in the evangelical movement. But his sermons as delivered are lost to history. We just don't, all we have is testimonies of people of what it was like to be there, including very famous testimonies by Ben Franklin in his autobiography, who was just stunned by the power of Whitfield's preaching, even though Franklin never accepted Christ for himself. And so I think Whitfield is a character who sets the pattern for British and American and in his way global evangelicalism in the appeal to people to be born again in incredibly hard work, passionate preaching, rigorous biblicism in his preaching. And he sets a pattern for thousands of preachers that, whether they know it or not, have come in his wake. And so I think that's why I would want people to know more about Whitfield than many people and many Christians do today.
And that's a very good answer. And I would just encourage people to check out your work on Whitfield if they want to learn more. It's very helpful. So thank you.
Well, Dr. Kidd, what, as the Christian church in America, should we be cautious not to repeat?
Well, I think that history doesn't repeat itself in the exact sequence of events, right? I mean, but I think that we look back on history and we see themes and parallels that do repeat themselves. And I think that one of the things that we really learn from the mistakes of the church in the past is how easy it is for the church to become captive to the dominant culture and get involved in overtly sinful behavior that people don't necessarily even realize that they're doing it at the time. I mean, you can point to the German churches, most of them in Nazi Germany, the churches, cooperating with communist powers and so forth. So there's some real obvious examples like that. And in America, I mean, you have episodes, most obviously slavery, where a lot of the church and a lot of pastors endorsed slavery, I think, feeling like they were, on really strong biblical grounds, when in retrospect, it seems like a lot of what they were doing was just blessing the dominant culture, especially in the South, to go along with what, in my view, was a fundamentally sinful institution, especially because of the way it was based on what the Bible calls man-stealing, snatching people away and selling them into slavery, and then the way that it was also based on the indiscriminate breakup of slave families. A very high percentage of slave marriages, slave parents and children were broken up in the antebellum period in the United States through the sale of individual slaves, not to mention, of course, the endemic abuse and sexual and physical abuse that went along with the slave system. It's not so much a point to, wag our fingers at people in the past and say, oh, we're so much more morally sophisticated than they are. I think we've got to be cautious about that, too. But it's just that we have to always be on guard in our current cultural situation, realizing that all the pressure is to go along to get along. And I think we see that in some forms and recognize it and are vigilant about it in the way that conservative churches are trying to hold the line on issues about marriage and sexuality today or about abortion. But it also, I think that there's temptations all the time of getting sucked in to political causes that may at least distract us from the church's business. We just got to always remember that people, if the Lord tarries, that people 200-300 years from now are likely going to be looking back at us and saying, what were they thinking about, and and we may just not even be able to see it, you know, what some of our worst offenses are, because sin tends to not only drag us into things we shouldn't be doing, but it blinds us. Our own sin nature blinds us to what our sin is. So I'm generally just struck by that danger of always being at risk of accommodating the culture in ways that turn out to be sinful.
Yeah, that's a really good answer.
Well, we've kind of been talking about this question, so I don't know if there's anything else that you want to add to this, but in case you do, here's the question. If you don't, that's okay. What do most people misunderstand about the founding of our country?
Well, I think it does go back to my previous answer, that we tend to have this kind of polarized view of the only options about the founding are that it was totally Christian or it was totally secular. And that's the way that our politics tends to play out today. At least that's the impression that we have. And so we think, well, that means that the people in 1776 must have been that way too. And part of my personal goal as a historian is to show that there are a lot of people involved with the founding who are just unlike anybody that we know today. So, for instance, Ben Franklin, who I mentioned before, resisted George Whitefield's overtures. I mean, George Whitefield personally witnessed to Ben Franklin trying to get him to accept Christ for salvation, and Franklin would not do it. He said, directly to Whitefield, "I won't." So they were having that discussion in just amazing ways. And so you'd think, oh, well, so Franklin, and he called himself a deist in his autobiography, so he must have been secular. And that's what our present-minded attitude towards the founding says. And I don't see any useful way to talk about Franklin being a secular person, mostly because he grew up in a Puritan family in Boston, and he had so much of the King James Bible memorized, and he knew it like the back of his hand, and could quote it from memory, and was constantly citing the Bible in his writings, and he deeply respected the Bible and its teachings. But on critical points, he had gone heterodox, especially about the divinity of Christ, and so that's one of the reasons why he wouldn't accept Christ the way that Whitefield wanted him to, is because Franklin doubted whether Jesus really was the Son of God. But if we think, oh, he's a deist, therefore he's maybe like one of the new atheists today or something like that, he's not like that at all. He knows the Bible backwards and forwards. He knows the Bible better than a lot of evangelical Christians do today. And so he becomes this, when you see what he's really like, he's a very deeply biblically literate deist, right? So I think we just tend to put the founding and the founders into these binaries that make sense to us today, but they do not make sense in 1776.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Well, here we come to a pretty controversial question, and I think it is a controversial question, and for a lot of reasons. But I'm really curious about your answer to this one. What character traits should American Christians look for in their political leaders?
Well, the founding fathers, across the board theologically, from people like Franklin to more traditional Christians like a Patrick Henry, believed that if you're going to have a republic, and they believe they were founding a republic without a monarch, but not really a democracy either, that you had to have people in office, but also the people at large who were virtuous. And when they talked about virtue, they would begin for sure with biblical standards of morality. And so even skeptics like Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, who I'm working on now, by and large took biblical morality as their kind of starting point for what virtue meant. Because, I mean, they wouldn't have known what other feasible source is there for defining what morality is. And they tended, people like Jefferson and Franklin tended to think that what you really want to do is focus on Jesus's ethical teachings, but set aside the idea of him being the Son of God. So even the skeptics at the time sort of widely agreed that biblical traditional Christian morality was what you would want in political leaders. And they especially believed that anything that had to do with public dealings, such as honesty, such as financial integrity, and these sorts of things that are going to touch on the way that this person operates in office, that you definitely would want to gravitate towards that type of candidate. And so one of the greatest advantages that the early founders had with the Declaration of Independence and the framing of the Constitution is that they knew, in particular with the framing of the Constitution, that if they created the presidency, that George Washington would be the first president. I mean, that was just taken as a given, and indeed he was unanimously elected by the Electoral College in his two elections. And the reason why they thought that Washington was the right choice was not only because he had had lots of successful leadership experience in the Continental Army, but they all, to a man, would have said, they would have cited his virtuous character, that he is honest, a man of just total integrity, and tries to do right by others in all of his dealings, that he lives out the golden rule, as it were. And so I think that those are really good guidelines, obviously, for us today. I think that we tend often to gravitate towards people who can be who have a compelling public personality in very different ways. You know, both Barack Obama and Donald Trump, you know, have this really compelling, appealing, even entertaining kind of public persona. And I can certainly understand gravitating towards those. It's better than someone who's just boring, but I think the founders would say that if given the choice between someone who has a long track record of virtuous behavior and then someone who was what they would call a demagogue, who had that kind of way of stirring up their constituency emotionally and through appeals to passion, that you definitely want to head in the direction of the person of consistent long-term virtue and integrity.
Yeah, that's really good. So as Christians, what we should look for is, is this person a person of integrity? Do they hold to values that we could support?
I tend to think of it as half of what you want. I mean, you want them to be all the way a person of integrity, but that's about half of what we're looking for, and that part of it, I think, tends to be relatively nonpartisan. I think we can all agree, I assume, that you don't want somebody like Richard Nixon in office who destroyed his presidency through his lack of integrity. I mean, that to me should be a relatively nonpartisan issue. And then the other half of what you're looking for is agreement on policy issues. And presumably there's not going to be any candidate who is going to perfectly reflect the kind of character you want or the kind of policies that you want. But I think in recent years we've tended to look only at a policy agreement, and we forget about the relatively nonpartisan part about what is their personal what's their personal characteristics, what's the nature of their family life, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, definitely, I agree. To what degree did Christian theology shape or not shape the founding of America?
I think that that theology and more generally Christian morality, ideas about Christian morality, really profoundly shaped the founding. In particular, the value that they attach to the need for virtue in a republic, as I said before, and then also their understanding that people are not naturally good. That was very widely understood among the founders, and it comes out in some really foundational texts in the 1770s and 80s. I think particularly of Federalist 51, which is likely written by Madison, James Madison, and he talks about he's talking about the nature of government and why you have checks and balances in government, and he says you have to pit the interests of government one against the other, so the different branches of the government one against the other, and then the different levels of federal, state, and even local governments against one another, because you have to assume that they will try to take all the power and abuse the people governed if they have the opportunity to do that. Office holders will do that. And Madison says along the way, he says, what is government itself but one of the greatest commentaries on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If people were naturally good, you could just let them manage their own affairs without government and without police. But of course, we all know that you can't leave people alone to just manage their own affairs, or else society will descend into chaos, violence, and anarchy. I think Madison at least is kind of distilling principles that he had learned and confirmed to him at Princeton in the 1760s and 70s. He was a student of John Witherspoon's at Princeton. And of course, you don't need specifically Calvinism to come to these kinds of beliefs. I mean, I think they're fairly generically understood among Christians. But Princeton in Madison's time was a Calvinist institution. And so there's at least that kind of filtering effect that Calvinism has, at least for Madison, on what is the nature of humankind. And I think Madison there is advancing a sort of political version of an understanding of pretty grim human depravity. And that's why you need government. And you better take account for that in government. And so the more sort of Christian America writers will try to say, oh, look, you know, here's a Bible verse that they use to set up the Constitution or something like that. I think most of that kind of thing is a stretch. But when you talk about the level of worldview and assumptions about morality and assumptions about human nature, that's where the influence of the Bible and Christian theology comes in pretty strongly with the founders.
I think that's a fantastic, very helpful answer. In the past decade or so, we've seen fights about the Supreme Court, and the intensity just seems to ratchet up, increase with every announcement coming out of the Supreme Court. How should Christians thoughtfully respond not only to the decisions of the Supreme Court, but in general think about the Supreme Court itself?
Well, I think I'm struck by how strange our politics has become with regard to the Supreme Court, that we choose presidential candidates in hope that they will nominate the sort of Supreme Court justices who then will often go on to play this really aggressive role on the court that, what wasn't really even intended by the founders. I mean, the founders definitely just wanted the Supreme Court to interpret the law and play a mediating role between different branches of the federal government and in various kinds of federal cases. The idea that judicial review has become sort of the main business of the Supreme Court was not what the founders intended at all. And of course, that the power of judicial review is not granted in the Constitution, at least not explicitly. It was asserted to the court by the court in the case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, that the Supreme Court has the power to review the constitutionality of, in that case, federal law. And so you come down to today, we have 50 years and more of a legacy of a very aggressive Supreme Court that now uses the Constitution and the amendments so often in a kind of legislative capacity where they're really making up laws for themselves. And so then that creates a situation where the voters feel like they're indirectly electing sort of quasi-legislators as judges, and hoping that, you know, somehow maybe this president that we're electing will then go on to make good choices about the Supreme Court and get who we want on the court. It is grotesquely distended from what the founders originally envisioned for the court. So in some ways, my answer is just to lament that we've gotten so far away from the original view of what the federal courts and the Supreme Court in particular were supposed to do. I certainly don't think that your average average voter can do anything to get away from this system. I mean, because it's so well entrenched now that this has just become a common feature of American politics. And, for me, I just appreciate, and this is just my own political view, I appreciate judges who see themselves as having a limited role, see themselves as not trying to overturn society and remake society in their own image, but that they are operating with restraint within the bounds of the Constitution, within the bounds of federal law, and that they don't see themselves as quasi-legislators. Whatever your political persuasion, I guess I would hope that we could affirm the value of judges who interpret law and don't make law. I think we're closer to being able to affirm that as a society than we are, being able to agree on the kind of partisan issues that divide us over the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really helpful answer. Dr. Kidd, there's a lot that we haven't talked about this topic. And just as we wrap up, do you have a few takeaways for our listeners?
Well, I do. I would recommend that Christians listening try to be conversant with their own history, especially religious history, because if we don't do that, I think we get into this sort of pretty immature attitude about, you know, that nothing especially interesting or significant has happened in between me and Jesus, the time of Jesus. I mean, it's as if we're just kind of making things up as we go along, and it's not true. It's not biblical. I mean, we are exhorted to pay attention to the cloud of witnesses, and that is obviously begins with the Bible. But there are Christians in the past, George Whitefield just being one of them, who I think we definitely should know about, be encouraged by, be chastened by the people's failings, because all of our heroes of the faith are going to have certain failings for sure, just like we do. But I guess I would just encourage people to try to make space for, in our kind of entertainment saturated culture, for continued learning not just history, of course, but since we're on that topic, that history, I think, can be a really valuable resource and storehouse for wisdom. And I think we should avail ourselves of that.
That's really a wonderful answer, Dr. Kidd. One last question. Where can people go to find out more about your work?
Well, any of my books are going to be available on Amazon.com for sure. This textbook in particular, because it's partly designed to be used in courses, probably most obviously in college courses, but I think it would also possibly work in a kind of AP U.S. history level course. And if you're a teacher listening to this, you can request an exam copy of the book at bhacademic.com.
Where can people also find you on like social media and those kind of things?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram. At all those, I'm at Thomas S. Kidd.
Wonderful, Dr. Kidd. Well, I want to say thank you for your time today. I appreciate your thoughtful answers. You definitely have given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate that and your work. So may Christ richly bless you, brother.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope that you were encouraged by today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. For more uplifting and thought-provoking content, please visit us online at servantsofgrace.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Servants of Grace, and on Facebook at facebook.com/servantsofgrace. We hope you have a blessed day, and we will see you next time.